Good evening, and welcome to this MomsFightingAutism.com webinar. My name is Chantal Cecile Kira, and this evening I'm your host as well as your coach. I usually serve as a moderator on the conferences here at MomsFightingAutism.com, but this evening I decided to have a special session and whereby I could answer the questions that are called in and written in by people who are listening. Later on in this program, we will have the opportunity for people to call in with questions. So you may wonder, why am I on here accepting to answer your questions and thinking that I could possibly coach or mentor you? Well, I have to say that my first contact with autism was not with my son, Jeremy, who is now 21, but my first real job out of college. I worked at a state hospital for the developmentally disabled here in the state of California, and I worked with the first couple of young adults that were going to be living in group homes. So I helped teach the first, actually, group of young adults here in the state of California that were going to be living in the community, being deinstitutionalized. And we use discrete trial, which is a form of applied behavior analysis, to teach them the community living skills that they needed to live out in the community. And then I was a case manager to families with children with developmental disabilities before moving to Europe. And in Europe, I did nothing that had anything to do with autism. But eventually, I had my son, Jeremy, who's now 21 and severely impaired with autism, and my daughter, Rebecca, who's 18 and neurotypical. And the thing is that at that time in France, there was nothing available to help people with autism because autism there was not considered a developmental disability, but rather a mental illness. And so I had my work cut out for me. I had to try and find resources for my son and try to teach him at home. Eventually, we moved to England and then back to California, where I knew that at least the laws were on my side, on Jeremy's side, I should say. Things have changed now in France, and they have improved over in England, but still, in America, we do have the best laws in terms of special education. So when my son was born in France, I got involved back in the autism community, and especially more so when I was back in California. And now my son is a client of some of the same agencies that I used to work with. Well, when my son was first diagnosed in France, I was told, at the same time that I was handed his diagnosis, I was handed the piece of advice, and that was to put him in an institution. And I'm happy to say he is now going to an institution. It's called college. And Jeremy graduated high school in June, and he is still severely impaired with autism. He had to do all his homework and pass all his proctored exams and non-proctored exams by pointing to letterboards or assistive technology kinds of devices. He actually gave a commemoration speech at his high school graduation, which is on YouTube. If you Google Jeremy Cecile Kira, Cicile hyphen Kira, you should be able to find on YouTube his commencement speech. Now, does this mean that he's no longer impaired with autism? No, it does not. In fact, today has been one of the hardest days that I have seen in Jeremy in at least maybe 4 years. So just because he has a high school diploma doesn't mean that everything's hunky-dory in the land of autism. But I want to say that that's one of the first pieces of advice that I would impart to people listening, is that you can't think when you're having bad days or that your child is having bad days, that's it, the world is going to end. Because like everything else, a bad day at work or a bad day with your husband or wife or a bad day on the stock market or whatever your problem may be, there's always tomorrow. And yes, when it comes to our kids, we have to look at the big picture, but we also have to look at the little picture and really not get overwhelmed with what comes next, but deal with today while moving ahead. And if I were to take a videotape of my son right now compared to a videotape that I could have taken of my son 4 days ago, you would not believe it was the same person. And those of you who have parents, those of you who are parents who have been around for a while and your kids are older will understand exactly what I mean. So if you are listening to this webinar thinking that I'm going to tell you exactly how to make your child become normal, I will tell you that there is no magic pill out there. But I will tell you that I can give you some tips on how to handle many things, because I've learned a lot of things besides raising my son and having worked with people with autism before. I've written 4 books, award-winning books. I won the Outstanding Literary Award from the Autism Society of America for my first book, Autism Spectrum Disorders, which is always usually and has always been in the top 20 books for Amazon rankings. So that's pretty good, considering. And my second book was Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum, and that's where I remind people and explain to them how, yes, your child is becoming an adolescent, and it's not just the autism getting worse, because people forget that when your child is an adolescent, you have a lot of issues to deal with that has nothing to do with autism. So it kind of aggravates the autism, but there's a lot of issues with being a teenager that has nothing to do with autism. In fact, when both my kids were in their teen years, I used to start all my talks on adolescence by saying, I have 2 children. One of them is severely impacted by autism and the other by hormones. Because my daughter, too, if I had taken a videotape of her 2 years ago and compared it with the videotape of today, we would be seeing 2 different people. Because 2 years ago, she was a very sullen teenager. I had no clue which way she was going to go. And today, she is one of the most well-adapted young people, cheerful, wonderful, that I've ever met in my life. So, who knows? That's why you can never think that today is what it's always going to be like. My third book is Autism Life Skills. And I wrote this book because my first 2 books were based on research, mostly, even though I did interview with people on the spectrum or read the books that they had written. It was basically written based on research. And when Jeremy was going through all transition, I started thinking, well, what would people with autism say was important to them growing up? What would adults now have to say about how they were best prepared for adult life? And those interviews became Autism Life Skills. And so that's a good book for any age child, the parents of any age child or teen to have, because it really gives you some hints as to what helped other people or what they wished we would have done to help them. And my last book is a very small book, which is a book that parents can hand to their mother-in-law, their neighbor, the bus driver, to people they wish would understand a bit more about autism, who wish they could spend a day in their shoes. And the title of it is 41 Things to Know About Autism. And it's part of a series by Turner Publications called Good Things to Know. And it's basically 41 questions, all the questions I get asked when I go places by people who don't know anything about autism. When I travel around to conferences, half the time I don't even want to tell the person sitting next to me on the plane that I'm going somewhere to speak about autism or that I write books on autism, because then I have to listen to their story about the people they know that have kids with autism and could I help them understand. Not that I don't want to help people, but sometimes I crave those 6 hours of quiet time on the plane all to myself without having to think about autism. But this book answers all those questions people ask. So that was just to let you know a bit about my background and why I might be able to answer some of your questions or give you some help along the way. I do want to say that Jeremy, my son, has decided that he likes to write. I guess part of it is that with his motor planning issues, it's very hard for him to do other kinds of physical work for money, and he's very in tune to the fact that he needs to earn a living. So, and he also wants to give back to the community. He wants to share what he knows about what it's like to be somebody who has the kind of autism that he has. Of course, remember that all these stories from people on the spectrum are personal to them. And as people on the spectrum like to say, when you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. So the thing is, recently Jeremy has been writing quite a bit, magazine articles. He wrote a monthly column for his school newspaper. And the thing that's been coming out recently in his articles, and also because I should say that people email both Jeremy and I a lot or write to us on Facebook, and they ask us questions. But they ask me questions to ask Jeremy. And a lot of times people, parents of nonverbal children, write, you know, wishing that they could teach their child to communicate like Jeremy. And they ask, what was it that really helped you growing up? And this goes to the major point that I want to make that we don't hear about from a lot of people, because we hear about all different types of techniques, we hear about all types of different therapies, but what is the main thing that's going to get you through the day, and what's going to make a main difference in your child's life that's going to get you to get the right treatments and therapies for your child is attitude. Jeremy writes, and I'm so surprised that he even remembers this, but he has written quite a few times in answer to people's questions and in articles that he's preparing and presentations as well, that the major thing that helped him in growing up was that every day when I put him to bed, I would say, I love you. And the other thing is that I would tell him that I knew that he was smart and that he could understand everything and that we were helping him, but I knew he was smart and he was understanding even if he couldn't talk back. And the thing is he says that kept him going all those years because he knew that we knew that he could understand, even though he didn't have any way of showing us. And when I say that he doesn't have any way of showing us, we did, you know, through data that we take and so forth with different therapies and so on. Jeremy always progressed slowly, but we did see he was learning. But there were little things that would happen every once in a while, not just at home, but with other people like at school or therapists, that they would understand that he had understood something. And so it just kept us going. And the other piece of philosophy that I have it's been a long day. But the other piece of information that I'd like to share is that if you think that your child does not understand, that's fine, because who knows? We don't know. But the point is that you should talk to them as if they do understand, because that's the only way that they're going to soak up information. And so if you treat your child like he doesn't understand, then and you don't speak normally in front of him, then you know what? He's not going to learn to understand because he's not getting the information. And I'm finding out now that for the years that Jeremy could not communicate, when I insisted that he be mainstreamed for at least two classes a semester, he was not able to participate, but he could sit and listen. All those years, he was soaking up the information in the classroom. So by the time he was able, after many years of work, to spell out, that's how come he was able to be ahead and not and make up for lost time, because he had all this information that he'd been listening to. And so when he got tested at school, and when they started reviewing material with him, they could see that there was material that he knew, and then there were many holes in his learning. Well, all the material that he knew were from the classes he'd sat in on, and all the big holes that he had was all the information that, you know, he'd never been taught, and he'd never sat in classes that had to do with that kind of information. So I'm not saying that everybody's a Jeremy, but I'm saying that we don't know about people that cannot communicate. So I prefer to think that the glass is half full and to act accordingly, because what's the worst that can happen? Is so you waste a little time, you know, talking correctly and talking as if you're talking to someone who understands everything. But meanwhile, you still do all the therapies and treatments that make sense for your child. So anyway, those are my little pieces of advice this evening. And there are a lot of questions here. And so I am going to start answering some questions. And during part of this webinar, I will be taking questions from call-ins. But first, I'm going to answer a few questions. The first question I'm going to answer is from a person who actually emailed me when they heard that I was doing this webinar. So I hope they're listening now. They wanted to know, how do you know if your baby has autism or not? Like, what are the early signs? What red flags are they? So I'm going to mention a few of them right now. And I'd like to mention a website, which is firstsigns.org, firstsigns.org. And they have a page, which is the red flags. It's firstsigns.org, concerns, flags. And I'm going to read some of these to you, and then I'm going to add a couple of my own that are not on here. But okay, so there, in clinical terms, there are a few absolute indicators often referred to as red flags that indicate that a child should be evaluated. For a parent, these are the red flags that your child should be screened to ensure that he or she is on the right developmental path. Okay, so here's some of them. You know that autism is based on, a diagnosis of autism is based on impairments in social interaction, impairments in communication, and repetitive behaviors and restricted interests. So here are red flags for impairment in social interaction. Lack of appropriate eye gaze, lack of warm, joyful expressions, lack of sharing interest or enjoyment, lack of response to name. For impairment in communication, there's lack of showing gestures, lack of coordination of nonverbal communication. And that's important to note because some people will say, oh, well, if your child's not speaking before the age of two, it just means that he needs a speech therapist, or he has problems just with communication. Well, is there also a lack of coordination of nonverbal communication? What does his nonverbal communication look like? Okay, unusual prosody, which means little variation in pitch or odd intonations. Okay, repetitive behaviors and restricted interest means that there are repetitive movements with objects and repetitive movements or posturing of body, arms, hands, or fingers. I want to also say that this red flags doesn't mention things that are really important to note, such as that some children develop normally and then regress at the age of 18, well, between the ages of 18 months and 24 months. And we call that regressive type autism. So a child has developed normally and then regressed. And so they may have had normal development type of behaviors, but after the age of 18, somewhere between 18 and 24 months of age, they start to develop some of these things here that I just mentioned, and also they begin to lose some of the skills that they have learned. So that's for the person who wrote in to me. Okay. There are so many interesting questions here. I'm going to start with one that someone's asking about my son. This is from Lisa in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Can you talk about how you have helped Jeremy move towards self-advocacy? Yes, that was a process, and it's still ongoing, but it improves constantly. We did it as part of his IEP. Also as part of his IEP team meetings. And what that means is that, okay, first I'll talk about how we did it at school and through the IEP process, is that every year after the age of 16, Jeremy was supposed to be giving input on his IEP in terms of transition and his goals for the future. And this is a law under IDEA. Some states have it as low as 14, but federal law is at the age of 16, that students must give input to their IEPs in some form. And at the beginning, Jeremy could not communicate well enough to participate or to spell out, but we observed things that he liked to do, and that's how we made a report about that and gave that in. But Jeremy started learning how to type, and he just wrote a paragraph one year about his thoughts about the future. And then, so that was the start when we knew that he was really thinking and applying things about himself to the future. And when we realized that, we thought, okay, he needs to really start thinking about the future and how he can build that, but also we know now that he can really handle speaking up for himself. So we started giving him at home more and more challenges in the way of communicating for himself and what he wanted. One way to start self-advocacy with really small children is giving them a lot more choices. And also, if they have a way to communicate either with assistive technology or if they're verbal, when they order in a restaurant, give them the ability to make a point about how they want their food so that they're actually ordering. And if they have specifics about the food, that they can actually tell the waitress themselves. I know this sounds like the really picky eater, but I don't mean it that way. I mean more like the picky adult person who goes into a restaurant and knows how they want their salad with the dressing on the side. You kind of teach your child to be able to discuss and tell somebody what they want in terms of their food, because food is very motivating for most people. Just those little things. Also, when you give them a choice, respecting their choice. That's how it starts at home when they're little, okay? I should have started with that perhaps and going directly into the IEP. But you see, because of the fact that we always tried to give Jeremy more and more choice as he got older, even when he wasn't able to communicate by writing, he could point to things. And we would give him choices, for example, in his schedule as he got older. So, you know, when he came home from school, he had to do chores, he had to do homework. And he also had to take the dog for a walk. Well, which did he want to do first? It was no longer us creating his schedule. It was him creating his schedule. So all that gives people the feeling that they have a right to have an opinion. So by the time they get to the 16-year-old, I'm now giving information at the IEP, they understand that they have the right to speak about themselves. And then also, meanwhile, there has to be work going on. And I was really lucky because we had an extraordinary teacher for Jeremy, just a great guy. He was great with all the students, all types of students. I mean, he wasn't an autism specialist. He was just a great teacher. And he started to explain to Jeremy, you know, that he had autism and asking Jeremy questions, what's difficult for you? Okay, and so now when you're going into class, what kind of accommodations do you need? So they would talk about how he needs to have books read to him because his vision processing wasn't working, and he needs to have the test questions read to him, and he needs to be able to point to the letters. So he needs a letter board, or he needed a choice board. All these kinds of things that you teach them about themselves and about their disability, you know, as well as their abilities. And matter-of-factly, so it's not a negative, teaches them that they have the right to ask for certain things, because now Jeremy is going to community college. I am not allowed to go to community college, and I'm not allowed to ask for things for him. He has to go, and yes, he has a support person, which is a really good thing because he feels the comfort of having someone next to him, which a lot of the kids with Asperger's don't have, which is really hard, because then if they haven't learned the self-advocacy skills, it's hard for them to request accommodations. But he is the one who has to request, not the support person. So there's no way he'd be able to do that now if I hadn't started so many years before. And that's another thing that I want to tell people, is that it's work, and but if you start earlier than later, it's a little bit at a time and it builds. The skills build, and the window of opportunity never closes, so it's never too late. Okay, so My goodness, Jennifer from Westernport is asking a really hard question. How can you say no without getting an autism tantrum? Well, you know, it depends. Are we talking about a good day or a bad day? So, like, today is a day where I'm not even going to attempt a no with my son. But on other days, no works out okay because he understands that there are a lot of yeses in his day. And also at 21, it's a little different from when you're dealing with a child who's three. So you really have to early on teach your child appropriate behaviors, and that it's really, really hard as a parent to do without support from the school district or someone else. And putting in positives. One way that I would do it if I didn't have the help of a professional is to give positive reinforcement to a child whenever he's doing anything right. Because I think that a lot of times we forget that even with our neurotypical kids, we're always asking them to do things, and we're always complaining when they don't do things instead of noticing when they do things right. And the first thing I would do is to notice when they do things right and make that so reinforcing. And, you know, sometimes you are going to get that autism tantrum with the no, but if it's at home and they're not hurting anybody, they're not hurting themselves, well, you know what? Eventually they learn that the tantrum didn't get them what they want. And really, that's one way of dealing with it. I need to say before I continue this that any advice that I give, I'm not a medical doctor and I'm not a trained ABA person. I'm just telling you from experiences, okay? So obviously there are tantrums and there are tantrums. So if your tantrums are so severe that it's hurting your child or he's hurting others, then you really need to get a behavioral expert in on the situation. Belinda Daniels from Rockmart, Georgia, wants to know, is anger a part of autism? You know what? Anger is a part of real life, regardless of whether you have autism or not. And the problem is that if you have autism, okay, you have problems with communicating, you have problems with social skills, and you have problems with managing your sensory as well as your emotional status. So your processing is out of whack. And so there's so many reasons why somebody could get angry. Imagine if you were somebody stuck in a body and you had no way of communicating and you were really frustrated. That would come out as anger. If you weren't getting your way, that would be anger. But the point is figuring out a way for a person to communicate. For example, before Jeremy could type, he could hand us peck pictures, okay? So, I mean, he could tell us what he wanted. He couldn't tell us that he was hurt. He couldn't tell us anything about his day, basically, but at least we knew what he needed and what he wanted, which is primary needs. So an important thing to do is to early on teach about emotions, even if you think your child doesn't understand. And you can do that by showing them pictures of people with different emotions and explaining what that is, or when you see someone crying or laughing or looking angry or upset, or when you are, you tell them, you know, I'm angry, this is what angry looks like, or I'm happy, this is what happy looks like, or I'm crying, this is what crying looks like, and then explain why you're feeling those feelings. But anger in itself is not really a part of autism, it's a part of life, but imagine if you have no, if you feel like nobody's understanding you, you're going to get angry and frustrated. Okay, so now I am going to see how this call-in situation works here. So I am going to ask, for those who would like to ask a question by phone, to please raise your hand. And one way of raising your hand here that I can see online is to press star 2. So if you would like to ask a question, press star 2 on your telephone. And I'll see if I can hear you. Nobody has a question. I see there's a lot of you on here right now. Okay, well, I'm going to continue now with my question and answer. And if you would like to chime in, please raise your hand. I have plenty more questions here. There are at least 60 of them. Okay, here's one from Adam in Leominster, Massachusetts. How do you choose a school? How do you choose a school? That's a very good question. You choose a school, first of all, you have to look at where it is that you're living, because in many places you can only attend schools in your school district. Sometimes there are exchanges between school districts, or if your school district cannot provide you a fair and appropriate education, then you can ask for a private school, but that's another situation. But in choosing a school, the first thing I would do is look at my child. And that's why it's really important for parents to get to know their child, how their child learns. So how do you figure out how your child learns? When they're little, you know, you're looking at your child, you're figuring out what are they doing to look at, how are they interacting with the environments around them? So are they, do they seem to be more in tune to people speaking to them or sounds? Do they react to sounds more than they react to things that they see? Do they seem to learn by doing? You want to look at those criteria for your child, okay? You also have to see what the sensory processing situation is for your child, also how their communication is. So first of all, you have to look at your child. Then you need to look at what the different schools' reputations are in your area, and that you can do by contacting parents in local autism organizations that are in your area. If you have the National Autism Association, or you have TACA, Talk About Curing Autism Now, or you have the Autism Society of America, they all have chapters, and you may have other support groups in your area. You can find out which schools are more autism-friendly, and don't look just at the teachers. Teachers are very important. The aides are very important because they're the frontline staff. But what's also important is the administration of your school district, because if you have a really crappy administration and that good teacher leaves the district, you know, you don't know how that program is going to continue. You want to know that a program or a school seems to have a history of, good autism programming from a while, not just because this teacher's there. It has to be more than that. Also, every child on the spectrum is different, and so you need to see what kind of offerings they're giving to different parents, and you have to realize that your child is an individual, and he has the right to an IEP, an Individualized Educational Program. And so you want to go to a school that respects your child's individual needs. So that's a start. Okay, I'm going to go back and check to see if anybody's brave enough to ask a question. Any star twos here? I see a couple hands. Okay, I am going to, I think I'm supposed to push on this button. I'm going to try this. Hello? I'm going to try again. I may have to ask my, I'm going to try one more button here, and if not, I'm going to ask my technical director for assistance. Hello, can you hear me? Okay. I'll be right back. I'm asking my technical assistant, Ernest Priestley, for some help. Because I see the hands up, Ernest, but I do not know how to pick them up. Hello? Hello? Okay, well, I'm going to wait for Ernest to chime in here. Don't give up. I will soon figure this out. Meanwhile, I'm going to go back to answering another question. Okay. Okay, here is Cordell and Laura P. for Edmonton asking, does anyone know exactly what causes them not to be able to talk? What is the prohibitor? There's a lot of different reasons why someone may not be able to speak. For some, it could be what they call apraxia. For some, it could be problems with muscle tone. There's a lot of different reasons, but again, there's not one reason that is true for everyone. Okay? How? Is that Ernest? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, is this, I have Honda Poway is the name. Is that your name?
Yes, that's me. I'm calling from work. My name is Aida.
Oh, hi, Aida. How are you?
Good, thank you. We spoke on a couple of occasions. I have a question.
Go ahead. Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you great.
Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, he recently has started hitting himself in the head, and of course he's nonverbal, no communication other than gestures. And so I know this might be a question for a doctor more, but because you have so much experience and you've researched so much and gone so far with Jeremy, have you had any incidents like that with him where he went through a self-abusive behavior?
Yes, and Jeremy hasn't hit his head, but he slaps himself repeatedly on the chest or the arm, and he can do this. He does this occasionally. He doesn't do this all the time, but it's usually moments of upset and anxiety. But the thing is that I need to say is that all behaviors are a form of communication.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times behaviors look at extinguishing the behavior or redirecting, which is really good advice, but it's also important to figure out why someone is doing that. So I don't know why your son is hitting his head, but, you know, maybe he's hurting somewhere and he can't tell you. And that's why it's important that when you're looking at something like that, that you also check with the doctor, because maybe he's having headaches. Maybe he's having other things going on.
We did. We went through the whole checkup, MRI, CAT scan, everything, and no one can find anything. And he seems to be doing it not just when he's upset, but, you know, whatever he's doing, it's like an automatic thing. As soon as his hands are free, he'll go for the head.
Well, maybe it's become a learned behavior at this point, but does he have a form of communication like pecs or sign language or
We're incorporating RPM, but it's difficult to find people that in San Diego that work with that, and I work 40 hours a week at least.
Right.
So it's difficult, but yes, we are trying to do that, and he seems to have, he knows how to point. And he seems to be going for the letters, but really no communication yet in that way.
With Jeremy, when he first started pointing, what Soma told us, because we were lucky enough, for those who are listening, RPM is the rapid prompting method, and it's a way of teaching academics. So you first, it's sort of like the tell and then ask paradigm, where you're giving information and you're asking questions based on the information that you just gave. And then first the person learns to point to written words, like just three, there are three choices and they have to pick the correct one.
Mm-hmm.
So you do that and eventually it builds to being open-ended communication. But I have to say for Jeremy, who was taught directly by Soma, who started the method, I took him to LA twice a month for about a year and a half. It took like a good year and a half, and Jeremy, again, anything that takes physical work, motor skills, takes a long time for Jeremy.
Yes.
And so it took him a long time, but, you know, Soma gave me the best advice ever, And even if you work 40 hours a week, I'm going to give you the same advice because maybe it's going to make you feel better or help you out.
Mm-hmm.
She told me, because I was, like, overwhelmed, I don't work a regular 9-to-5 job, but I still work writing my books and
mm-hmm.
writing articles and, you know, earning money. And I just have more flexibility with my time, which is great. But she said to me, just do half an hour, a good half an hour every day, you know, or 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So when she said that to me, it really freed me up because I wasn't thinking like ABA, oh, my God, it has to be 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, there was other things that he was learning and he was doing other things. But I've just made sure that I myself used, you know, I used 10 minutes to prepare the lesson because I wasn't really natural at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then 20 minutes of teaching. So he really only had half an hour of RPM a day.
And he took to it right away?
He didn't take to it right away. He took to, you know, to trying to do it, but it's work. And first of all, they have to get used to being in that setting. They have to be used to that you're making demands on them. You know, just like it, you know your child better than I do, but like I know Jeremy, he likes change, like if we're traveling and it's fun and it's vacation,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't like change when it's new demands being put on him.
No.
And so it took him a long time for him to get used to it. Now, it's not that he doesn't like it, but it's hard because of all the sensory processing and the new way of doing something, and he has to get himself together and organize to do that. And so it took quite a while. And it took a long time for us to get from going from three choices to a QWERTY or an alphabet board, because you're going then from three choices to 26 choices because there's 26 letters, right?
Right.
So it's all little baby steps. And but just knowing that every day I did 20 minutes of good work with him, you know, and every day he got used to the fact that come rain or shine, we were doing that 20 minutes today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it, the regularity of it. So if I know that you're working 40 hours a week, but even if you just have that half an hour that you could do, and you know what, you feel so much better yourself.
Yes, no guilt.
Okay, wow, so I took 10 minutes to prepare this. You know, maybe you don't make it 20 minutes, you make it 15 minutes, whatever it is, but it has to be regular and consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Because then he's going to understand and get used to it over time. And so will you, and you're going to get better at it. I mean, like now, I can do it so easily, and it's funny because when I'm trying to hire people to help with Jeremy, you know, in-home support staff or respite workers or whatever, and I'm whipping through, like, the RPM with Jeremy, and then I have them sit down and try, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I remember. It used to be hard to think of a question to ask. So that's why you prepare ahead of time a lesson, and that's the way that I would say, don't think way ahead, oh, my God, he has to communicate. First of all, you want him to understand what you're telling him and go through the basic making a choice. That's the first step.
And because he has the motor development problems, the motor skills, was it easier for him to point to the letters on the letter board that Soma has or the round thing? What did you use originally?
Well, you know, Jeremy was one of Soma's early clients, and so I'm sure it's developed a lot more from now in terms of what she uses. But what we used at the time was pointing to or having Jeremy pick up a letter. Like she would just write or I would write the choices on pieces of paper that we would rip in front of him. So when he heard the ripping sound,
mm-hmm.
thought, okay, now I'm going to have to give a response.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would just have to pick up the paper and hand it to us, the correct answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I went to the pointing. But so it just depends on your child.
And how old was he when you started this with him?
13 or 14.
Okay, so there's always hope.
Oh, my gosh, there's always hope. And Jeremy didn't really start doing full sentences till he was 16.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what? It's slow and steady, but that's okay. You know, there's always hope.
It's in the right direction.
Every day, just a little bit. And don't worry about it.
And as far as the head hitting or the hitting, do you try to stop Jeremy and say, no,
well,
hands down, stop, or?
Well, then you're giving it more attention. And with Jeremy, it never gets to that point. It's not, I mean, if Jeremy were hitting his head, I would probably be more concerned about it. Not that I'm not concerned about it, but we do a lot of sensory integration. But I know that right now for Jeremy, it's moments of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And happens, something really bad happened to my son about 3 or 4 years ago at this time of the year. So at this time of the year, he goes through this anxiety. And no matter what we do, he just has to go through it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the head hitting, that's, you know, if it was something that Jeremy did on a regular basis constantly, I would be more concerned about it, and I am concerned about it. We're always teaching him ways to self-regulate, but head hitting, that's something definitely...
Yeah, it's scary.
It is scary. And so if the doctors can't find anything, and I know that you're looking at the communication, I don't know, have you ever tried looking to see if there are other issues that he has, like biomedical issues that perhaps regular doctors aren't finding? You know, like, I don't know if you've ever seen a Dan doctor?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I haven't really had much success with a
right.
Dan doctor. Do you have any recommendations?
No, I don't. But, I mean, I've used different ones. But, you know, I think for every child it's different. I was just wondering if you had looked into that area.
Would you consider medication?
You know what? If it's to that point, yes, I would consider medication. I'm not a big one for I'm not big on medication, but you know what? It all depends on the state of mm-hmm. the situation. And also, your child's a teenager. Was
yes.
he doing this before?
He started about a year ago.
And how old?
Around 15.
Yeah, so it could have to do with anxieties of being a teenager as well.
And
so I would see if you could find a therapist or a good psychiatrist to work with him.
Okay.
But, you know, I wouldn't consider medication on its own, but as part of a whole package, you know, like other therapies that you're trying, like communication that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that'll help in the end, in the long term.
That's what I'm hoping for, yes. Communication is the key.
You're on the right track with that, but just give yourself... You know, like I said, 20 minutes to half an hour every day, and he'll get used to it, and you'll get used to it, and then you'll feel better because you'll have accomplished that much. But he's not going to go to the open-ended questions right away. It's more about giving him, talking to him about something or reading something to him, and then asking him questions about the information you just gave him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. Try that.
All right. Thank you, Chantel.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, back to some questions that were sent in. Oh, boy, there's so many here. I'm not quite sure which ones to answer first. Okay. This is from Srabani Bozi, and I'm sorry if I'm massacring your name. As my name is Chantal Cecile Kira, you can understand I get my name massacred all the time as well. And this person's from Calgary. My son is 14 and still very limited speech. Our mother tongue is not English. I don't know what language will help him to learn speaking with understanding. He is a homeschooled student, and I'm also more comfortable in my own language. Please advise me what is good for us. Okay. When Jeremy was little, we had the same situation because I'm raised bilingual French, and Jeremy was born in France, and at first we had English in the home so that he could have both languages, English at home and French outside the home. But then we moved to England, and so then we started speaking French at home. And the speech therapist in England said, only speak one language because you're confusing him. So we stuck only to English. So... which was kind of a shame because my daughter did not learn to speak French. And you know what? If you speak to most speech therapists now, and I can tell you for Jeremy now, that that's not true, that speaking two languages is going to confuse them. If they're understanding, they're going to understand in both languages. And if you're comfortable in your own language, it's better to talk to them in your own language. In fact, for children who are listening and hearing, it's better for you perhaps to use the same language with them. You know, so maybe you speak whatever your mother tongue is, but if other people are speaking to him another language, that's fine. What's more confusing, I would think, is if you're speaking both languages to him. So I would say use whatever language is more comfortable for you. Okay, I'm going to check on the phone. Okay. Here's someone else who wants to call in. Hello? Hello? Well, I guess I'm not very good at this. I'm not very good at answering the phones, or maybe they're hanging up on me. I'm going to check with my technical advisor. Okay, so I'm going to tell you again to press star 2, and then when I can unmute them, when I can, I will unmute you, and then you can speak. That's what I'm doing. Let's try it again. Okay. Hello? Do you hear
Hello?
Me? Okay, great. It's worked. I have you down as anonymous. Do you want to say who you are? Hello? Can you hear me? Hello? 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 Okay, well, we did hear somebody, and now I don't hear them anymore. I'm going back to the questions here. Okay. Lori Ledbetter in Raleigh, North Carolina. I have an autistic nonverbal 12-year-old daughter whose self-abusive and aggressive behaviors have led us to apply for a second term of residential treatment. I feel like a failure. Should I? Hello, is somebody there? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me? Hello? Okay. Anyway, I'm going to answer this question from Lori since the other person's not coming through on the phone. Lori, no. You should not feel like a failure. You know, it's not your fault that your child has these self-abusive, aggressive behaviors. It's not her fault. And so you, as a parent, have done everything you can so that your child is in a situation where they're going to get the help they need or that they're in a place that is safer than home right now for them. And what I mean by safer is that I just know from Jeremy when he's, having a rough spell, it's not, if he were like that all the time, it would not be the safest place for him to be at home because there's things that they can get hurt with, that they can hurt themselves. And as parents, you can't put up with that 24 hours a day. And it's not fair to other people in the home if there are other people in the home. When they're living in a residential facility, they're getting care from other people who are trained. The place is safe. And also, the people there know how to deal with it, and they have different staff. So the staff there aren't worn out like the parents are worn out. And you know, you love your daughter. You've done the best that you can. And just because she's in there in a residential treatment place does not mean that you're a failure. Sometimes a residential treatment place is the best for them because they need a 24-hour program. You know, I've wondered often about that because if I'd stayed in England, probably Jeremy would be in a residential treatment program because over there they have schools that are like boarding schools. And if Jeremy had been staying over there, maybe he would be doing better if he were in that kind of situation, if he was in a really good place and basically home on the weekends or even not home on the weekends. Who knows? But the point is that there's certain things that you can't take care of at home that other people can take care of. And you know, you can still visit your daughter, and perhaps your daughter will be home another time, but do not feel like a failure because it's not something that you've done. It's nothing that you've done. It's not something that you've chosen. Okay. Here's a question from Jeff in MI, which I think is Missouri. Chantel, how do we stop our son from thinking everyone is hitting him or against him? If someone bumps him on accident, he will say they hit him. If someone pats his back, they have hit him. And he always starts fights or lies with other people. How do we stop this behavior? Part of the behavior might be that he's very sensorily sensitive, and so if someone bumps into him on accident, or if someone pats him on the back, that's a very, maybe it feels like he's getting hit to him. So, first of all, you know, I don't know if your child has any sensory issues, but I would look at that. I would look at how people are feeling about, or how he is feeling about the situation of what it feels like. What, do you notice that in other aspects about him? Does he get upset with scratchy material on his skin? Does he avoid certain contact? So that's one thing. The as he's always starts fights or lies with or about people, it sounds like you have a lot of challenges there, and I wonder if you've tried to have any therapists work with him, if you have a psychologist or a MSW who could work with him. Cognitive behavior therapy is often helpful in these kinds of situations. You don't say how old your son is, but I would think that at this point getting professional help on how to handle it would be a good thing. Okay, do I dare try the phone again? Okay, so I'm going to unmute this person. Hello? Yes, hi.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Oh, yay. Every time somebody else would try to talk, I found I had to mute or I was in the way.
You know, I am really sorry, and I apologize to everyone about this because I've never used the call-in before, and so I'm trying to...
Well, that's okay. We'll work it out.
But I think I've worked it out now, and I have to say that the years that I was living in France, I was actually a TV producer, and I had people that did everything for me, so now I have to do everything on the computer. It's really hard for me, but I'm learning. So how can I help? What is your name?
Yeah, my question for you, my name's Paula, and I have a little boy with classic autism who is almost six. And similar to the last caller, he's doing some self-injurious behavior. His is unfortunately gouging his face and his lips and chest and neck and arms and hands. And he was pretty well shredded on one side of his face from doing this. And we didn't know if it was a delayed reaction to risperidone because he is extremely aggressive. And even though he's only five, he was hurting his younger sister and gave me a couple of black eyes and bloody nose and split my lips open and stuff. So it was out of control, and we had to do something to control the aggression. So he started with the shredding of his face and his lips out of nowhere. And again, it was sort of like the other person where it didn't seem to have any reason. He just almost like a stimming behavior of just kind of reaching up and grabbing his face. And what I wanted to know from you is not why is he doing it and how to get him to stop, but how, as a mom, how do I deal with that emotionally? I mean, what coping mechanisms are there for, you know, having your child hurting themselves and not being able to stop them?
I know. It's so, so tough. I mean, I'm lucky in that with Jeremy, as I said, it's you know, it's kind of rare, and but when it's going on, like right now as we're speaking, I can hear him running around the house and him slapping, like, the walls. And he's not hurting himself. His dad's with him, and he's also slapping his chest.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's nothing like that. But, you know, you wonder if it's going to escalate. And you feel so bad because you're thinking, why, what is he trying to communicate or what is he trying to tell us? That's the first thing. And then secondly, how do I get him to stop and how do I get him to be calm? Because you feel as a parent, that's the first thing is you want to keep your kids safe.
Right.
You know, your first thing is you want to keep them safe from others, but here it's from themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that emotionally, you just have to, well, does he do this 24 hours a day?
Well, that's just that he had just kind of started the behavior about 2 weeks ago, and it was pretty much just all day reaching up and grabbing so quickly that, you know, there wasn't really anything you could do, and there's no way to glove him. It's hot, and he...
Yeah, and then when they also...
Find a way to get it off anyway.
When they hit you, it's really hard, too, because... You're beginning to feel like that, what did you do that now they're angry at you? But the person realizes they're not angry at you, like with...
No. Well, he is. When I say he can't have something, he does get angry. But I deal with that. What's hard is that he hurts his sister, and that's why the medication really had to come into play.
But is he hurting reaction to something, or is it that he just can't control his body?
It's both. It's if he gets angry, you know, okay, all done cheese, no more cheese, bam. He's headbutting me in the stomach, chasing down his sister to throw her to the ground, sweeping everything off the counter, knock over the chair.
How old
he's
is
almost
it?
Six.
And
oh, he has a 7-year-old sister and a 4-year-old, and he's always targeted the younger sister, though now he will hurt them both.
Okay, well, the first thing, I know this sounds really tough, and I know you're asked more about how to deal with it emotionally, but you have to make sure that the two daughters are safe.
Yeah, I it's hard because he's so dang fast, and if they happen to be too close to him, he's so has such a short fuse that you don't realize. And, you know, Emily, especially the little one, I try to approach him very cautiously when I know I have to take something from him that maybe he shouldn't have. That's dangerous, and nonchalantly, and kind of get a hold of it before he realizes it. Because if I say no, he'll throw it. And if he's throwing scissors or throwing a glass full of milk, and you know, he's, but my 4-year-old will say, "No, Tanner, don't do that." And then, whoo, he throws it, and you know it's hard.
I'm sure you.
But I do. I mean, she knows to kind of hide behind me when he's panting. I pull her behind me, and, you know, but it is. It's, and the older he gets, the more scared I get, you know, because he's getting bigger and stronger.
You have
and
a behavior.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Oh, I was apologizing to my neighbor because he picked a rose. I'm sorry.
Do you have a behavioral expert who's helping
you?
You
know, with our situation, we have full-time school stuff, and they're really awesome with them, but our insurance is privately funded, and they don't cover really anything outside of...
What are his behaviors like at school?
He has similar problems, but he has that routine, and they're able to kind of keep him calmer. He really acts the worst for me. If once Daddy comes home, that behavior drops to 10%, but when it's just me, I'm like his little personal punching bag. Tanner, I'm sorry.
Oh,
okay.
Is there any way of having more of a schedule at home when you're there with him?
Well, I work part-time, and my mom does daycare part-time, and yeah, it's very frustrating, and I wanted very much to get something scheduled for the summer, but unfortunately, everything was either just way too expensive or they had waiting lists a year ago, and, you know, it's just
I know. I think that it's another parent and I were speaking the other day about how that the society does not realize how stressful it is to be the parent of a child with autism.
Yeah.
They really don't. And the thing is with more and more kids having autism, they really need to wake up to the fact that as families we need help. And it's really hard.
Like, we qualify for respite care and all this stuff, but there's no money in the program. So.
Right. You're an awesome mom because you're doing everything that you can. You sound like a really, really wonderful person.
Well, thank you. I feel bad because everybody else talks about Dan doctors and doing this and doing that.
You know what?
Oh, man, I can't do any of that. We don't do any of that. And Amy, he's been going to school full time since he turned 3 years old, and I feel like how much more can you ask of him? You know, he's gone 8 hours a day, 5 days a week to school. I don't know. It's hard.
Does he have a good, the person who's helping you with the medication, do they have a good handle on it?
Well, I just saw a psychiatrist today, and it took me like 2 months to get the appointment because I didn't feel our pediatrician really new.
That's a good thing. But does this psychiatrist have experience with kids with autism?
Yes,
like
she specializes in autism. How much?
You can ask them too, like what kind of autism that they've dealt with. You know, like has he experienced with kids that are like yours?
Yeah, that's true. I was so busy talking about him, I didn't think to ask about her, but I will.
You know what? It's funny because I took Jeremy to a psychiatrist that was recommended to me, and again, I just assumed. And it's like I'm stupid. My son's 20. You think I would have known by now? I mean, he was 20. So I take him in to see this psychiatrist. And, you know, Jeremy at this point was communicating on the computer. And after, like, the fifth or sixth session, if he's so smart, why can't he talk? I thought, okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Got autism. How could she ask me that? So I thought, okay, she's supposed to help me find drugs for my son or plans for my son, and she doesn't know. You know, that someone could be smart but not be able to talk. That was kind of kind of hard.
Telling.
It's good that you already have somebody, and hopefully that person has the experience necessary. It sounds like you're doing what you can. And I would just think that if behavior plan that's working at school, too, that if you could try and do it at home. I know it's so hard on the mom because when we're the ones who are at home with them more, and we do end up becoming the punching bag because they're trying to get away with stuff with us that they are not away with at school. And it's really tough because you have those young girls, too.
Yeah.
And I think to feel better about it, too, if you ever have the opportunity to spend, you know, during the week, like maybe, you know, 1 hour or half an hour or just 10 minutes a day with one of the girls, you know, separately away from your son, and maybe your son alone without the girls. Just a little bit, even if it's 10 minutes, you know. We kind of had...
At night, that's pretty much our private time, one-on-one reading to everybody individually and that kind of stuff.
I think you're doing the best that you can, and I'm really happy to hear that you're seeing a psychiatrist for your son. And I think maybe try and see if, like, one thing they do at school that's really helpful that maybe you could integrate at home for your time when you're at home alone with him and the two girls that might help.
Yeah, I will do that. They don't let us come to the school because we disrupt them a lot, you know, as parents. So I really don't know how they manage things, but I talk to his teacher a lot, and I'll just maybe drop her a line and ask her if she had to, you know, if there's one thing that she found really particularly helpful, maybe that I can incorporate and share with my mom, too, as the daycare provider. I'll do that.
And you know what? That's a great point. And if you write it, it's easier because, as you said, they're really busy, too. And this way they don't have to answer the phone.
Right.
They could send a note back home.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye. Okay, now I'm... hello? Is this Danielle?
Hello. Yes.
Okay, we're speaking now to Danielle in Pompano Beach. Thank you for being so patient.
That's okay.
You know, I think I finally figured this out after the third call.
You're getting good at it now.
Yeah. I figure if it takes me 3 times to figure this out, that's why it takes my son so long to learn everything, too. So how can I help you, Danielle?
Well, my son is 5, and since he was about 2, I kind of knew something was wrong, and he really fell through the cracks. I took him to 2 neurologists who were hesitant about diagnosing him. We have the Dan Marino Autism Center down here, which, you know, people come from all over to see them. And so finally after going back and forth with them, I finally ended up getting a diagnosis through the school board because we just recently had his IEP for his transition into kindergarten. He's been going to special needs school since he was just about 3, 2 to 3. So I kind of feel like, you know, I read Jenny McCarthy's book, and she talks about the window, you know, and he's very high functioning. He doesn't talk. But I have one of my best friend's sons, you know, he's at the severe end of the spectrum. So I can see, you know, they're like night and day. But now that he has his diagnosis, it's kind of all new to me. I really don't know where to start or what to do as far as getting him extra therapy. He's going into kindergarten. He'll be going into an autism cluster. Like, what do I do now? Because before it was, you know, severe language delay or, you know, that no one really knew what was wrong with him because he didn't display the, you know, the common characteristics that a lot of autistic kids, you know, share in common. The, you know, he makes eye contact. He interacts good. He's the youngest of four.
That makes him appear to have autism? Does he have a lot of sensory processing issues? Does he?
He did. They're getting a little better now, but obviously nonverbal. You know, he's five. He does have some behavioral characteristics, the tantrums. He doesn't really have any self-stimulation or anything like that. He doesn't injure himself, thankfully. He does have some aggression problems, but, I mean, I just don't know what to do as far
as
getting...
How does he communicate?
Well, that's another thing that the doctors were saying, because he's the youngest of four, so he has five of us, you know, wrapped around his fingers. We all know what he wants when he wants it by the way he cries or if he goes in the kitchen and points at something. You know, he only eats certain things, you know, typically. And so we kind of, the kids don't really make him communicate. They just automatically know. To avoid hearing Christian cry, they give him what he wants, and, you know, that's the bad part of having the three other ones to baby him. But I think he lacks, because we're so used to him and how he is and our life in general, how to get his environment conducive to, you know, pulling him out of that quote-unquote window, because he has the potential, I believe.
Right.
I mean, he's trying to talk. He'll say a few words here and there.
Well, I would say, and I know that as a mom of four kids, you're probably very busy. And you
and I work, and I go to school, so it's like...
Right. Well, you can't expect the other kids to be asking him say the words, you know, it's normal if they kind of want to give him something because that's his way of communicating with them.
Right.
But do you have the opportunity yourself or your husband of spending a little time with him and just, you know, making sure that he does say the word or ask for something in an appropriate way and not just give him when he cries, so that even if he just does that a little bit more?
Yeah, we do. My husband and I do. Like, if he wants...
Okay.
You know, if he wants more food and he just starts whining, you know, we'll say more. And we incorporate the sign language with it. My husband's kind of against that, but I feel like it's getting to the point where we have to kind of start exploring other ways.
Oh, is that what you're using? The way of communication is the sign language?
Well, no, he learns it in school, too. I mean, with the verbal. But, like, you know, we'll say more and we'll wait for him to, you know, verbalize it somewhat.
The thing is, the research shows that when you teach an alternative means of communication, like the sign language, it does not at all make them become less verbal. So you're,
and that's what my husband thinks.
I know, but a lot of speech therapists don't know that either.
Right.
But the research that has come out, and I've heard this many times from speech therapists who know about research, they say, you know, having another way of communicating can only help the communication come out, the verbal come out.
Right.
And so I think that I would really look at school, too. Are they just trying to get him to verbally speak more, or have they thought, is the sign language another form of communication, or is there something else that they're trying to do? Because if there is another form of communication, maybe it can help the verbal come out.
Yeah, they use the the touch audio devices. They use the PECs. They use sign language. I mean, because there's so many different types of kids in his class. You know, it's not a strictly autism school like Bowdoin or somewhere like that.
Do they take the time, or does anyone take the time to kind of repeat things with him?
I switched his school about a year and a half ago, and this school, he's come leaps and bounds compared to the last school.
That's great.
Yeah, it's good. It's just, I'm just trying to, with him going into kindergarten, I just want to make sure that, you know, we're doing...
In the cluster, you said it's an autism cluster. Are there other verbal kids there?
I'm not sure yet. I did the tour, but it was, you know, right after spring break.
Well, that's the thing you want to make sure is that he is spending time with verbal kids, because if he's just going to be in a classroom with nonverbals,
mm-hmm.
who is he going to learn
to
speak
talk
from?
To. Yeah. And they said they would mainstream him for specials in PE, and then, I guess reevaluate him through his IEPs.
If he can handle it, if he's ready for it, if he can handle it, I would say trying to get him mainstreamed more than just for PE, because then he's going to hear a lot more language, because language
right.
when you hear a lot more language as well.
Right. And the other question I wanted to ask you, because I work and my husband works, I've had a problem because he's pretty typical besides being nonverbal and he's not potty trained yet. I'm having a really hard time finding aftercare for him. And, I read a lot on, the Americans with Disabilities Act regulations for child care providers, and all of them that I've called have been, they're not educated on it at all. But do you have any suggestions on how to go about that?
I really don't, except I know that each state has a developmental disabilities website, like
mm-hmm.
a department. Developmental disabilities, and they have your rights listed. But you say you already know what the rights are.
Yeah, and I've informed the people when they I explain to him he has. First, I ask if they, because a lot of the research I did said not to off the bat say my son has autism. Do you have room for him? Do you call and you ask first? Do you have room for this age group for aftercare? If they say yes, and whatever, and then you disclose to them, okay, well, this is, my son's situation, et cetera, et cetera. He's not potty trained, but, by law, they're supposed to make reasonable accommodations for them.
Right.
And right off the bat, when they hear autism or not potty trained, well, we don't take five-year-olds that aren't potty trained. We don't specialize in children with disabilities. And I said, well, you need, and I educate them. I tell them, you need to familiarize yourself with this, because
right.
if you say what you just said to the wrong person, you could lose everything you have because they could sue you.
Right.
So,
well, that's the thing I would ask you is, do you have contact with any families, like any support groups of kids with autism in your area? Because maybe some of those parents will have had your experience and will know of resources. That's the
I have to look into it. Like I said, I've been dealing with no diagnosis for so long. Now that he has one, I'm just trying to
right.
get into that mindset of, because he couldn't get the extra therapy before without a diagnosis,
right.
and he couldn't get the special insurance without the diagnosis. And now that he has it, I just don't really know, where to turn, but I'm going to look into the support groups and...
The support group, they might be able to help you with some information.
Yeah.
I know in our area it's a good way to get information about certain places. And
right.
do you have any kind of... I don't know, I'm not familiar with your state, but do you have case managers or social workers that are assigned to you that can help you?
Well, through his insurance, there is a case manager, but it's mainly just for, she told me how to go about, trying to get him the extra therapy to go through his pediatrician. But even his pediatrician really hasn't acknowledged his diagnosis. So
I know it's hard.
It's hard. I mean, you're getting like five different, people that you trust telling you different things or not telling you anything. you know, and if you could have gotten, instead of an hour a week speech therapy, you know, 3 or 4 hours a week since he was two, he could be, you know, talking
right
by now. But so that's frustrating. But
it is frustrating, but
it is what it is, I guess, and we just go from here.
Exactly. You can't beat up yourself over things like that because you're doing the best that you can, and you have your hands full. So I would try to connect with other parents who could tell you about the child care situation, because
mm-hmm.
there must be others in your situation.
Yeah.
So find out what the resources are.
All right. Well, thank you, Chantel.
Well, I hope that I've been a little bit helpful, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Here's a question from Angie Rodriguez from Rialto, California. I was told that my daughter does not qualify for an IEP. I'm sorry, I have to mute this phone, don't I? Okay. I'm sorry, back to here. I'm really not a good technical person, am I? Okay, back to Angie. I was told that my daughter does not qualify for an IEP, but she is diagnosed with Asperger's. I feel that I am not approaching her situation correctly. I was told by the school psych that Aspies are not considered damaged enough to qualify for resources. She is high-functioning but needs help socially. What should I do? She currently has a 504 plan in place. Okay, well, I think that a star should be given to the school psychologist, because that's the first time I've ever heard about Aspies not being considered damaged enough. That's even, I've never even heard of Aspies being considered damaged. So that's quite interesting, and I'm sorry that you're living in an area that has such a school psych, if that's what she has said. I do understand that in the sorry state of California right now with the budgets the way they are, that sometimes in some areas, not under school law, though, but regional centers sometimes are not giving, providing services to children diagnosed with Asperger's because there are not enough resources to go around, and they're actually giving more resources to kids that are more severely impacted. However, under IDEA, it's not about who is considered damaged enough or not damaged enough. It really has to do with the child's educational needs. If your child needs help socially, that's an educational need because they need to learn their social skills. Social skills are part of what they should be learning at school. And so, first of all, you have to deal with this school psych that Aspies are not considered damaged enough to qualify for resources. The first thing that I would do is I would get an assessment. If you have insurance that covers it, I would get an assessment by an outside psychologist. Find out from your local autism society or if you have other organizations in your area like the National Autism Association or TACA or I think there's even FEET. Then find out what psychologist in your area is familiar with Asperger's syndrome and for the challenges that children with Asperger's face, because then you could find out not only the positive aspects your child has, but also the deficits, because it is unfortunately the deficits that will get you that IEP for your daughter. So I would look into an assessment by a psychologist who is knowledgeable about Asperger's and also about what students can ask for or should be getting at school to help them. Because you know what? That is really a stupid thing for the school psychologist to say, because what, you're supposed to wait around till your child is considered damaged enough to require help? You know, that's like saying, I'm not going to give you a cane, but if you're bad enough to need a wheelchair, you can have a wheelchair. So, okay. Anyway, seriously, I would try and get an assessment by another psychologist. And I would also start documenting all the things she needs help with at school. And in a non-emotional manner, you can write that up and start taking notes on that and see someone at your school about it. But the psychologist's assessment would be the best thing to do to start. Okay. More questions. There are so many here. Okay, Ariel Miles from Yanceyville, North Carolina, wants to know. This person says, my child has autism. She's 10 years old. I just want to know, does autism get worse the older they get? Well, yes and no. A lot of times when kids hit puberty, could be at 9 or 10 or 11, it appears as if their autism is getting worse because their behaviors may get worse, and because they do a lot of things that we consider as worse, where other people might consider it normal teenage behavior. So, for example, when they hit puberty, their hormones start growing and moving, and they start changing, their bodies start changing, and oftentimes people with autism or children with autism have a hard time with that, especially if they're used to sameness and rigidity and they like things to be the same, because imagine if you like things being the same and your body starts to change and no one had told you that was going to happen and you have no control over it. That is really difficult for them. So sometimes they get really anxious and nervous about that. So a lot of telling them and showing them pictures of mom and dad when they were younger and now older and explaining to them about puberty is helpful. The other way that people seem to think their autism gets worse as they get older is that all teenagers are non-compliant, okay? Teenagers do not want to do what their parents want them to do. That's it. End of story. Okay? So now imagine that you're a teenager. You also have autism, and you have no way of being non-compliant because, let's say, you're a person with autism who's nonverbal. So let's take, for example, my son. If he's a teenager, maybe his wants and needs are different than when he was 9 years old. But at home, because he doesn't talk to me, because he's nonverbal, I still continue to do the same patterns of treating him as if he were nine. And I still make him do the same thing every day after school. And I don't change anything. I don't give him the opportunity to make choices. Then he will become very noncompliant because that's what teenagers do. So as they get older, you want to make sure that you give them lots of choices. So as I was explaining about Jeremy making his own schedule, that's one way as they get older. So for some, the autism appears to get worse because also there's a higher risk of depression in the teen years. Also, as you've been hearing from people that have been calling in, or my story about Jeremy and his hyperactivity this evening, he is acting, he's running around the house a bit. He's hitting himself in the wall, slapping. He's having a lot of... And I know for Jeremy what the reason is. He's having a lot of emotional overwhelm right now. But it doesn't make it any easier as a parent to sit there and hear that or feel that. But when they're little and they're doing that, it's bad. But imagine you have someone who's just as big as you are doing that, and you're trying to keep them safe. So it feels like their autism is getting worse in that sense. But on the other hand, it gets a lot better in a lot of ways. Like Jeremy now can communicate. Jeremy... most of the time can act appropriately in public. He can sit through a two-hour class, which he would never able to do when he was little. So there are a lot of things that can improve as they get older. And again, there are things that can get worse, but you have to be able to see the difference between what's getting worse and that you can do something about, because many times there are things that you can do. And I just want to tell parents that as you get older, it gets harder, too, because you're older. So, you know, when your kid's 16, you don't have the same energy you did when they were 6. And there's a reason why most people have kids when they're younger and not when they're in their 40s. It's because you have a lot more energy when you're in your 20s and 30s than when you're in your 40s. So when your kids get older, you have less energy, and it just seems that they're getting worse in a lot of ways. But really, it's just that we're tired. So here's a question from Francelle in Hayward. How can I aid my son in reducing his emotional tantrums, his coping and focusing skills? Gosh, I don't know how old your son is, Francelle, because depending on how old my answer might be different. But first of all, for someone to be able to control their emotional tantrums, they have to understand what emotions are. They have to understand a little bit about self-awareness so they can understand what it is that they're feeling, because unless they understand what they're feeling, then they can't control them. And coping and focusing has a lot to do with sensory overwhelm and emotional overwhelm and things sometimes can get better when they learn to regulate. Sometimes occupational therapy can help with that. Sometimes there are vitamins and natural supplements that can help with those kinds of things. Sometimes behavioral plans, social plans, social stories is a big thing too. So not at the moment that someone's in emotional turmoil, but afterwards. Like, for example, right now when Jeremy's going through all his overwhelm, is not a good time for me to be asking him why he's acting the way he is and trying to have a conversation with him. But I'm going to have to wait till he calms down. And when he's calm and more relaxed, we could talk about how it felt, what he was going through, and what were some things that might help him next time. And what was he feeling? Why was he having this emotional tantrum? And then also trying to notice, if you can, a pattern of what seems to be happening, what his body seems to be doing before he hits that emotional tantrum of no return. So that if you can identify it, then when he's calm, you can try to help him identify when what it feels like in his body when he's hitting those moments where he's hitting that point of no return. Because if he can identify before that he's going to be in that state, over time he can learn some coping skills for dealing with that. Once he's at the point of no return, he's at the point of no return. And that's one way of handling it. So I'm not quite sure how old your son is, but I'm hoping that that is helpful. I'm going to check back now and see if anybody's is trying to call in. Nope, everybody's just happy to be listening in. Okay, if you want to call in, go ahead and hit *2. That's how you raise your hand. Just hit *2 and I'll notice you soon. Okay, Laura Prediger from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, has a comment for the lady who, with the son that hits himself. She mentioned that she says, no more cheese. Well, I just about jumped out of my chair. Please tell her to get him off of dairy. This is the first step that no one has told her. Then after that, she can get him off of gluten and certainly sugars and colors. Okay, I do want to say, I think I had mentioned the DAN doctors, but one thing that people can try is diet, because diet does affect behavior. I'm glad, Laura, that you brought that up. Let's not even talk about the dairy and gluten right now, but really a lot of the foods that people tend to feed their kids nowadays has a lot of preservatives in it, a lot of sugars in it, a lot of artificial coloring. That stuff is just crap, okay? Whether you're autistic or non-autistic, it's terrible for you, okay? So you should try and not have those kinds of foods, okay? The other thing is that for people who have allergies or reactions to dairy and gluten, that can cause people to be hitting themselves or having other behaviors. So that's another thing to do, is to try going on a no casein and no gluten. So that's a casein-free and gluten-free diet. And you can do that without going to see a doctor. And now it's easier than even 5 years ago, because there's lots of products out there now that are gluten-free and casein-free. You have to look very carefully on the packaging. And, you know, some doctors say just try it for a month. I've had other people tell me you really have to try it for 3 to 6 months to see if it's going to make a difference. So, but that is a good thing, and I'm sorry that I neglected to mention that earlier. So, that's a good point. Okay. Here's Rebecca in New York, who says, we have had to stay with my parents for 2 months during a job transfer home relocation. My 5-year-old autistic son has become very attached to my mother, so devoted that he will melt down from being separated for any amount of time. We are fearing the day we move out and wonder if you have any suggestions about the upcoming separation from her. Okay, so that's, boy, your son really likes his grandma, huh? You know, it's interesting, because I had something like that happen to my son, but I've heard this happen with other people as well. And sometimes what can happen is that if you're in a new environment or a different environment, and there is a person there that is a constant that your child is really attached to, that's who they're going to attach themselves to, because that's the constant. So, for example, for some kids, it's their stay-at-home mom. For others, it's their grandparent who's taking care of them. Whoever it is that's there at moments of change. So when you're moving from one environment to another environment, that's the thing that they're going to hold on to, is the thing that stays the same. And your son has attached himself to your mom. So what you want to think about is, you know, it's really hard that he's having meltdowns being separated from any amount of time. Think about talking about it to him, I mean, showing him pictures, social stories. You're going to have to start doing some unattachment with him, or detachment from the mom. And when you move away, I think you have to start now. I don't know when you're going to be moving, but you should start making a picture book. And as soon as you have a picture of pictures of where you're going to and pictures of what the travel is going to be like, explaining to him what's going to be going on there. And then also make sure you have pictures of your mom that you're going to be taking with you. Also, do you have any plans for mom to visit anytime down the road? But you want to make sure that when you leave, he can attach himself to somebody else. I don't know if you're working or your husband's going to be working full-time, or who's going to be watching and taking care of your child at that time. Other than that, I would say contact a professional who deals with these kinds of attachment issues. But that would be my first reaction. Okay. Here's one from Kimberly in Melbourne, Florida, and also from someone, BJ. BJ says, the diet never worked for us. The food tastes nasty. And Kimberly, Melbourne, Florida, says, Am I the only parent of an autistic child that with empirical evidence, not anecdotal, that shows the drastically unnatural for omnivores diets work? Whole, natural, yes, but gluten-free, dairy-free, etc. There is no scientific evidence from any reputable source I would like there to be before I do that to my child. Other moms think I'm abusive for feeding them food. What can I say to them? Well, first of all, I agree, Kimberly, with what you're bringing up. I believe in empirical evidence, but I do also believe in anecdotal evidence for some things. I don't believe that the diet works for absolutely everybody, but the reason why I suggest it is that it is something that you can do that's not going to do any harm, and it can be something that doesn't cost too much money and that you're not spending hundreds or thousands of dollars to go see a doctor. So if you are able to actually stick to it and try it out for a couple of months and take data on it, okay. And, you know, and if you can see a real change, fine. But obviously, I agree with you that whole and natural is the best way to go. And I'm not saying that gluten-free, dairy-free is going to be useful for everyone, but it doesn't hurt to try. So, and I understand that you say that there's no scientific evidence from any reputable source, but on the other hand, I know personally two very good friends of mine whose children's dramatically improved. I wouldn't say that they're cured. They're not. They're more like little Aspies now, but they were severely impacted. But it turns out that in their family, there was a history of immune system problems and also of other casein and gluten allergies, but in non-autistic family members. So the thing is, in my point of view, if it does no harm and it doesn't cost an arm and a leg, it's worth trying. Gosh, there are so many questions here. Before I continue with some more questions, I wanted to remind people, oh, there are some hands up, so I'm going to take some questions, but first I wanted to remind people that there is more information on my site, practical advice, also articles, more resources and tips, and also if you're interested in any kind of mentoring program or I'm going to be offering in September, October courses based on my books on the autism spectrum disorders and also a 6-week course based on my adolescents on the autism spectrum. So parents who have kids entering puberty may want to sign up for classes online. If you're interested, just send me a email through my website. My website is www.chantalsicile-kira.com. My website should be written up on the teleseminar or momsfinding.autism website somewhere. So shoot me an email. Okay, I'm going to take a question here. Hi, is that Samuel?
Hello? No.
Hello? No. Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Can
Hi.
You hear me?
Yes, I can.
Who am I speaking to?
My name is Anne-Marie Pizzone.
Oh, okay. Hi, Anne-Marie. Yes, because I see your name here, Samuel Pizzone, but obviously that's somebody
else. Yeah. Yeah, that's my husband, and the phone number's under his name. So, I have a 14-year-old son that he has high-functioning autism Asperger's, and I have him enrolled in a summer program, social communication program, because unfortunately the school district is just not providing him with those skills. And he's going to be entering high school next year, but it's like it's not a constant battle, but it just seems like he's so high-functioning. I don't know if this is worth the while of him, you know, going to this program and learning these skills, because he seems to know a lot of them already, and, you know, we're paying the money doesn't matter, but, you know, our insurance company, fortunately, is a very good one through my husband's work, and we're, you know, just paying a copay, you know, for each session. It's a 90-minute session 3 days a week.
And is it with,
and,
is it a group session?
Yes, it's a group session with adolescents. Like, there's six in a group, and it's through one of our local hearing and speech centers. But it's like, you know, 40 minutes away, and he seems like, you know, it's trying to pull teeth to try to get him to do the homework for it, because he says, Mom, I know this stuff.
Okay, but here's the thing. I don't know your child, but what I've heard from a lot of parents and also educators of teenagers with high-functioning autism or Asperger's is that if you sit down, that they're very good at memorizing things or learning things, but
right.
It's sort of like if they sit in a class and then, for example, psychologists will do an assessment, they can spit back the information. But actually what's happened is it's gone in one ear and out the other, but it hasn't stopped in the brain. And
right.
For the person to say, hey, this is information for me, it hasn't internalized. And so maybe he thinks he knows the information, and maybe he can spit it back to you, and that's why you know that you think he knows it. But does he show that he knows it in the way that he acts in a, you know, in social situations?
Yes,
that's
which
I would look at. He does?
Know, which I don't know about, because I really don't, you know, see
right.
One close friend. You know, I don't see it.
So do you have anybody that you can ask about that, like at school? Or, I mean, it's summertime, so maybe the schools, you can't, don't have access to anybody.
Yeah, no. Well, it's even on his IEP with his goals.
Right.
Every quarter, it was unable to document because either they didn't bother doing it or...
Okay, next time you get one of those reports,
mm-hmm.
I know it's easy to just... Not easy, it's easier because life is full of many things. You
right.
need to call and find out why.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry.
You know, that wasn't the battle we wanted to have this year. You know, there was
I know. You picked your battles.
You know, with him going to high school, so...
I know. Okay, so this this class, though, are they practicing the skill?
Yes, they are practicing skills like self-control, self-regulation.
You know what? I don't think it can hurt.
Yeah, I know. It can hurt, but, you know,
He's giving you grief about
it. You know, I hate for him to, even though he's locked up in his bedroom playing on his computer and, you know, doing the stuff that he really enjoys doing, you know, I don't, it's like I'm ruining his summer, you know?
You're not
ruining
his summer. You know what? A lot of 14-year-olds are out there doing other things they don't want to do, okay?
Yeah,
and
true.
I'm sorry, I'm making a bad point here, but just because somebody has autism or Asperger's doesn't excuse them for having a tough life in other areas or doing other things they have to do.
Yeah.
But I'm saying,
I guess you're right.
He has to make his bed and empty the dishwasher, you know, as much he can. And so, you know what, there are things that all of us don't want to do, and you can't think, well, he doesn't want to do it, and you know what, he's going to be picking up something or at least practicing the skill.
Okay. Yeah, because I had him in a program through one of our schools, a very good autistic school. I don't know if I can mention names, it probably doesn't matter. A connections group. It was called the connections group when he was first diagnosed at the age of 12. Everything fell into place, and he was able to go to this program. And he learned a lot of these social skills in that program because it was an intensive program 5 days a week from, like, you know, 8:30 in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. You know, and it was a stringent program through our Summit Educational Resources. And, you know, he learned a lot of these skills already in their program, but, and I just, because he's entering high school, I just want him to be natural at doing things.
Right.
You know, I know it's hard enough being a teenager, but being a teenager with autism, you know? And I figured, you know, I wanted
You just need to bite the bullet and tell him, you know what, there's some things that everybody has to do, some things they don't like to do, and that makes us appreciate the other things. So this is what you need to do this summer. So you don't get into the whether you need it or you don't need it kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for your book. It was
which book? Was it the Autism Life Skills or the Adolescent?
Yeah. I haven't read the Adolescent yet, and I'd love to read that book. I think I'm going to go to Borders tomorrow and, buy it.
I hope I've been helpful. I have to talk to two more people before I hang up here.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay. Let's see now. Hello?
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 Hello? Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. You're on the air, so do you have a question for me? We don't have very much time left.
Okay, my name is Deborah. I'm in Los Angeles, and I just wanted to make a few comments. One was that when my daughter did start talking, she said the reason why she couldn't talk before is she had so many thoughts in her head she didn't know what to say first.
Wow, that's a good one.
The speech therapist who is able to help her learn how to calm her brain down and figure out what to say first really helped with relaxation skills and self-regulation and things like that. The other thing was we did have a lot of sensory occupational therapy, and that helped a lot by a CIPS-certified therapist. This is before we got a diagnosis of autism. She got it really late in life, so there are parents who think that other parents who got a late diagnosis paid a doctor for the diagnosis, but that's not the case. It's just she's so high-functioning, it just took someone who asked the right questions and didn't just go by a rubric that was 50 years old.
That's right.
I'm hoping that the screening tests get better and that don't screen out people who actually, like you said about the high functioning, you know, their immediate recall may be 98%, but if they can't really internalize and transfer information and judgment, social judgment from one situation to the other, and then that's what I'm experiencing. So the doctor that did give her the autism diagnosis is high functioning, didn't feel like he wanted to refer her to regional center because how regional center is so impacted, but then he did recommend social skills, but we can't afford them on our own, and there aren't any programs through the insurance company that we have in our area. I'm very frustrated with that.
It is very frustrating. But you raised some really good points there about the teaching her how to deal with the frustration or to slow down so she could listen to or at least speak out one thought at a time. They do need a lot of time to process, and they need a lot of time to slow down. Sometimes we think that they're too slow, but they're not. In fact, sometimes they're going too fast inside. And the other thing, the sensory integration by trained people really is helpful for a lot of different areas. People that I interviewed for my book, Autism Life Skills, that was the number one thing that people mentioned as a problem in growing up was making sense of the world around them. And it was a lot of OT and sensory integration that helped them in those areas. And I think that you should still try with regional center and see if you can get any help. I know that the state has cut down on social skills type of things, but I think you should still at least go through the process so when it opens up again. And also, I think, how old did you say your daughter was, 5?
No. She's 15. She's concurrently enrolled in community college, and basically I'm getting a lot of the services through community college that we can't get through the K-12 system.
Okay. One thing that might help with her social judgment and social stuff is, have you done any acting classes? You have quite a few resources up there, and I have heard that Regional Center has paid for some acting classes.
I have heard that as well, and I haven't verified the information that they've stopped. So I need to verify
that, and also verify there's at least two, I don't can't think of the name off the top of my head, but there are two good resources up there. You want to check that they're teenagers similar to yours that benefited, because as you know, it's a spectrum. So, you know, something that benefits one child or one student may not be as beneficial for the other. I'm sure you're aware of that now that your daughter's 15. It sounds like you've done all of it already.
Well, I've done a lot of it, but today there was just another milestone, which kind of floored me. We were in a restaurant, and we had to go to the restroom, but there was a postal worker who needed to go to the restroom, and this is the first time she said that she felt compassion to somebody else, and she allowed her to go to the restroom before her.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, so she told me she was amazed at feeling that way. She hadn't felt that way before.
That's great. You know what? That brings up a really good point for all parents out there that anytime, I mean, that's a big milestone, but I like to look at what is the little thing today that really my son did that he hadn't done before, or even if it's such a thing as he finally calmed down by the end of the day if he's having a tough time. It's very rare that Jeremy has these tough times, and I'm just surprised because it's happening again this week, though I should know at this time of the year it happens. But, it's finding the thing that you can be happy about at the end of the day, the positive, and instead of thinking before you go to sleep of all the things that are wrong with your child or with your life, and I know that's hard, especially when you've got a child who's aggressive to himself or to others, but think about, is there some breakthrough in some other little way that you've managed that day that you can feel positive about? Thanks so much for sharing that with us.
That's great. Thanks. And the other thing I want, two more things, one real quick. I wanted to let people know that Feingold diet worked for us. She happened to have had eye twitches from orange juice that we didn't know about. And she was craving milk products, and limiting that really did help. And then the other thing is about the empirical, research and all that stuff. I explained to, we did the listening program, which is a Tomatis-based therapy, listening therapy, which really, really helped her verbalization. And I tried to, I was speaking to someone else, and she said, well, we don't see any research. And the issue was, my child is getting older. So if I wait for 10 years of research to get published and then get into practice, I'm going to miss the boat if it's a real good thing.
Yeah, I always tell parents that you have to look at what makes sense for your child, and because every child is different. So look at what makes sense for your child and see if it seems to help with children that are like yours, and if it's not going to hurt them, and you can get the funding for it in some way, or you can afford it, then try it. But again, take data while you're trying, and try one thing at a time, because if you try a lot of things at the same time, you won't know what it is that actually helped your child. And again, just because it worked for one person doesn't mean it worked for another, but you have to be kind of the expert and decide what can help your child.
Right. I met one person who said nothing helped her child except for ABA, and I was amazed because of all the things that have helped us. So it's individual. It really is.
It is very individual. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank
Bye
you.
Now.
Bye.
Okay, so we're getting towards the end here. I'm going to have to hang up. But before I hang up there, I'm really sorry I didn't get to all your questions, and I wasn't able to answer. Somebody here did ask me, a few people wrote in and asked for me to please give the email address again for those wanting to sign up for classes or more information about mentoring. Or also, I do send out a free monthly newsletter just once a month, and I always have a practical tip, and I review, some of the latest books that have come out and try and come up with some free or inexpensive things that can be helpful, because I know everybody has less money. I know my husband's been out of work for 5 months, so I appreciate any tips I can have on little money, things that cost little money but are helpful. So here is my, I'm going to give you my personal email as well as my website. My personal email is Cecile Kira, which is S-I-C-I-L-E-K-I-R-A at mac.com, and put in the subject, please, webinar, so I'll know why you're contacting me. But my website is my name, which is ChantelCecileKira.com. So ChantelCicile-Kira.com. And please just realize that you're doing the best that you can for your kids. You know what? You can't do better than your best. So I know as parents it's